A number of years ago, Judith Harris wrote a book called The Nurture Assumption, Why Children Turn Out the Way They Do. If you look that up on the internet, the first thing that comes up there, if you look it up by author and title, it says this: Do Parents Matter? In 1998, Judith Rich Harris, an independent researcher and textbook author, published The Nurture Assumption, Why Children Turn Out the Way They Do. The book provocatively argued that parents matter much less than is typically assumed, or at least when it comes to determining the behavior of their children. That's really an understatement of what's said in the book. The book is described this way on Amazon: This groundbreaking book, a Pulitzer Prize finalist and New York Times notable pick, rattled the psychological establishment when it was first published in 1998 by claiming that parents have little impact on their children's development. That's an understatement, too. This is from the preface to the first edition. Ms. Harris herself writes, "This book has two purposes. First, to dissuade you of the notion that a child's personality, what used to be called character, to dissuade you from the idea that it is shaped or modified by the child's parents. And second, to give you an alternative view of how the child's personality is shaped. My arguments against the old notion and in favor of the new one were originally sketched out in a 1995 article I wrote for the journal Psychological Review. The article began with these words, quote, Do parents have any important long-term effects on the development of their child's personality? This article examines the evidence and concludes that the answer is no. End quote. The book is called The Nurture Assumption. We talked about nature versus nurture a couple of weeks ago. It's called that because the book is Ms. Harris' efforts to prove that the idea that parents play any part in nurturing or influencing their children is an unwarranted and false assumption. I'm not going to keep on going on about this, but anyway, I'll say a few more things. On page 3 in chapter 1, she explains the title of the book by saying this: The nurture assumption is this. She's going to define it. The carefully designed studies carried out by developmental psychologists, with whom she disagrees, where parents who provide firm but not rigid limits for their children have children who are less likely to get into trouble. This is the model that she's showing is faulty. Parents who treat their children harshly tend to have children who are aggressive or anxious, or both. Parents who behave in an honest, kind, and conscientious manner with their children are likely to have children who also behave in an honest, kind, and conscientious manner. So on the next page, page 4, she says, The nurture assumption is not a truism. It is not even a universally acknowledged truth. It is a product of our culture. It is a cherished cultural myth. In the book, she says that your children are going to be who they are based primarily on two things: genetics and their peers. I find it fascinating that she thinks that the influence of their peers will have an impact, but apparently the influence of their parents won't. She did say, however, that because peers are so important, there is something parents can do. Well, that's good news. We've got some role we can play, I guess. She said they can make enough money so they can get to go to the best schools and be around the best peers. And parents can make enough money to buy and dress them in the latest styles because looks are important and you want them to be accepted by the right kids. And you might need to spring for some orthodontics and plastic surgery. That's what you can do as a parent. Remember, this book was described as the groundbreaking book, a Pulitzer Prize finalist and New York Times notable pick. Troublesome thing is how many of these books have been sold and read for it to reach that status. Based on 107 reviews, which is not a lot, it has 4 out of 5 stars on Amazon. Now, the fact is, in many cases, in many households, in many families, Judith Harris is exactly right. The only factors that determine how those children turn out are genetics and media or peers in some other form. But that's true only because the parents are not training their children. Parents have abdicated their role and do nothing more than shuttle the children back and forth to the next program or the next activity. Poor child grows up in a whirlwind, thinking life is about nothing more than the next sporting event, the next recreational activity, or the next entertainment adventure. Parents don't guide their children, they don't correct their children, they don't teach their children. Parents don't train their children. Role of a parent is to train their children. Now, we've talked about example and the need for that. We've talked about the need for the parent to be what they ought to be. And if you haven't heard Parenting 101, I recommend you go back and listen to that. It's on the website. That's the foundation for all this. You take away that part of what the parent ought to be, then you've kind of missed the whole thing. We've noted previously in this series that children are not automatons. That is, they're not robots who are programmed by their parents. They have no self-will. They do have self-will. Proverbs 22, verse 6 says, "Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it." That is a truism stated there, which is to say that that's the way it normally goes. That's the way life usually works. Train up a child in the way he should go, and usually, typically, when he's old, he will not depart from it. These are proverbs, they're not prophecies. For example, Proverbs 15:1 says, "A gentle answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger." Well, if someone's mad and unreasonable, it may not matter how gently you speak to them. You may not turn away their wrath. And if someone is calm and gentle and in tremendous control of themselves, you can speak harsh words to them and it may not stir up their anger. We need to realize how important it is to train children in the way they should go. Training has a lot to do with expectations. For example, if you expect your child to throw temper tantrums, guess what? Your child's going to throw temper tantrums because you're going to let them throw temper tantrums. We need to understand that children can read parents like a book. If a parent tells a child to do something, but the parent doesn't really have any conviction that the child's going to do it, if you don't really expect the child to do what you're telling them to do, or if you don't expect them to stop doing something when you tell them to stop doing something, the child will pick up on that and they'll know that you're not going to enforce it. If you talk to parents whose children throw temper tantrums, and if you ask them, "Do you expect that your child will not throw temper tantrums?" they will say, "Of course they will. That's what children do. I don't like it. I don't know what I can do about it. I hope he'll grow out of it, but that's what he does." And if you've trained your child not to throw temper tantrums, those parents will usually think that you just have good children. You just got lucky and they got lemons. But children know when you're serious. They know what you really expect. In 1 Samuel 2, verse 13 and verses 22 through 24, verse 13 says, "The sons of Eli were corrupt. They did not know the Lord. Now Eli was very old, and he heard everything his sons did to all Israel and how they lay with the women who assembled at the door of the tabernacle of meeting." In verse 23 and 24, we see, "So he said to them, 'Why do you do such things? For I hear of your evil dealings from all the people. No, my sons, for it is not a good report that I hear. You make the Lord's people transgress.'" Then a little later, in chapter 3, when God spoke to Samuel, God mentioned this. 1 Samuel 3, verses 11 through 13. Says, "Then the Lord said to Samuel, 'Behold, I will do something in Israel at which both ears of everyone who hears it will tingle. In that day I will perform against Eli all that I have spoken concerning his house from beginning to end. For I have told him that I will judge his house forever for the iniquity which he knows, because his sons made themselves vile, and he did not restrain them." Regarding Eli and his sons, one might say these were relatively grown men, or at least grown young men. That's true. And that, to me, takes the point even further. If Eli was expected to restrain them at this age, certainly he would have been expected to restrain their behavior at a younger age. He allowed this behavior. He put up with this behavior. Someone says, well, how could he stop it at this age? Well, you can stop it if you want to badly enough. I read the two following passages merely to make the point that if you're really serious about stopping a behavior, you will. Numbers 25, verses 1 through 11. While Israel was staying in Shittim, the men began to indulge in sexual immorality with Moabite women who invited them to the sacrifices to their gods. The people ate the sacrificial meal and bowed down before these gods. So Israel yoked themselves to the Baal of Peor, and the Lord's anger burned against them. The Lord said to Moses, take all the leaders of these people, kill them and expose them in broad daylight before the Lord, so that the Lord's fierce anger may turn away from Israel. So Moses said to Israel's judges, each of you must put to death those of your people who have yoked themselves to the Baal of Peor. Then an Israelite man brought into the camp a Midianite woman right before the eyes of Moses and the whole assembly of Israel while they were weeping at the entrance to the door of, to the tent of meeting. When Phinehas, son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, saw this, he left the assembly, took a spear in his hand, and followed the Israelite into the tent. He drove the spear into both of them, right through the Israelite man and into the woman's stomach. Then the plague against the Israelites was stopped, but those who died in the plague numbered 24,000. The Lord said to Moses, Phinehas, son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, has turned my anger away from the Israelites since he was zealous for my honor among them. As I am, I did not put an end to them in my zeal. Deuteronomy 21, 18 through 21. If someone has a stubborn and rebellious son who does not obey his father and mother and will not listen to them when they discipline him, his father and mother shall take hold of him and bring him to the elders at the gate of his town. They shall say to the elders, this son of ours is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey us. He is a glutton and a drunkard. Then all the men of his town are to stone him to death. You must purge the evil from among you. All Israel will hear of it and be afraid. Obviously, I'm not suggesting that you throw a spear at your children or that you stone them to death. That's not my point. My point is, if you're really serious about stopping a behavior, you will seek out, you will figure out a way, you will put a stop to it. And I will suggest that Eli had the responsibility, the duty to restrain these men, whether they were his sons or not, for the kind of behavior they were engaging in. Long ago and far away, I remember someone whose boys fought constantly. I don't remember, they were 8 and 12 years old, maybe something like that. Father would occasionally say, what are you supposed to do? When it was kind of obvious what was going on around you as you were ducking, and I'm just kidding, but wasn't that bad. Well, I find it interesting. If he came home and the boys were sitting there snorting cocaine on his kitchen table, would he have said, what are you supposed to do? No, he would have stopped it immediately. Point is, if the behavior is egregious enough, all of us will put a dead stop to it instantly. We allow, we tolerate everything else, and our children know it. So there's a degree to which your children live up to what you expect from them. By their comments, by their attitude, some parents send the message to their children that they expect them to fail. My brother went into the Marines back in the mid-70s. And when those new recruits get off the bus, does the drill instructor think that all those guys are going to be able to make a bed to his specifications right at that moment? Does he think that they'll be able to do as many push-ups as he expects, as many sit-ups as he expects, run as many miles as he expects, march the way that he expects them to march, and have all the disciplinary behaviors that he expects them to have as Marines? Does that drill instructor believe that the moment these guys get off the bus, that all of them or even one of them can meet up to his expectations? Of course not. But after 6 weeks, those men are making their beds the way he expects. They are doing the sit-ups and the push-ups and running and marching as required. They are meeting his expectations. Why? Why are they meeting his expectations? Because he was dead serious about seeing that they met them. And he truly expected them to meet those expectations. If he was half-hearted about it, if he was really uncertain as to whether they'd be able to do it or not, if he was not really sure if they would obey him or not, that would have been evident to them, and many or most or even all of them would not have met those expectations. He didn't tolerate, he didn't accept what did not fit his expectations. He allowed time for growth, and that's essential. But the demand and the expectation was always there, that eventually and sooner than many would expect, eventually these men would meet his expectations. When we expect bad behavior from our children, then we start tolerating bad behavior. We expect our children to lie. It will come across in our demeanor, and we'll start tolerating lying. When we expect them to argue with us and to become belligerent, maybe even strike out at us physically, we start tolerating those behaviors. We may fret about it. We may rant about it. We may lose our temper over it, but we allow it. Children know when you expect them to obey. The way we communicate with our children, the way we communicate with our children, says a lot to them about our expectations. Let me illustrate it this way. Let's say that for a week we observe the classroom of a grade school teacher who has the reputation of being the best disciplinarian in her district. She consistently has fewer behavior problems than any of her colleagues. What is she doing? First, she's making her expectations perfectly clear, which means she communicates in simple, declarative sentences. She does not use 50 words when she could use only 10. The more words you use to communicate your expectations, the less confident you sound. So this teacher uses as few words as possible in communicating with her students. Second, she prefaces her instructions to her students with authoritative phrases like, "I want you to," and "it's time for you to." She says, for example, "it's time for you to take out your math books and turn to page 25. Instead of saying, "let's take out our math books and turn to page 25, okay? The latter approach seeks approval from the children. It's asking permission. This approach begs for confrontation, for disagreement, for equivocation, for negotiation. Third, the teacher under discussion does not explain the motives. She does not explain the motives behind her instructions to her students. Why? Because she knows that explanations invite arguments. Whenever parents say they're dealing with an argumentative child, you can be certain that these well-intentioned parents are explaining themselves to their children. The older a child gets, there should be room for discussions and explanations after the child has done or stopped doing what you've told them to do. But these well-intentioned parents tell their children why, for example, they want him to pick up his toys. And he argues. They'll say something like, "you should pick up your toys because you could trip and hurt yourself." Well, somebody want to tell me what the child's going to say there? "I'll watch where I'm going." Well, maybe you won't say, "no, I'll see it." And here we go. Unless the child is extremely agreeable, when you start explaining why a child should or should not do something, the child is going to argue or at least question things. And he will argue because you can always pick apart an explanation. But if you don't explain yourself when you give an instruction to a child, then the child being a child is surely going to ask for one. He's going to ask why, or he's going to ask why not, at which point get ready for a big surprise. When he asks why or why not, your answer is going to be because I said so. And no, these words will not cause psychological damage to your child. Rather, these four words are a simple but powerful affirmation of the legitimacy of your authority. Say it calmly. Don't scream it. Don't yell it. Nothing good's ever accomplished by a person who screams or yells. There may be some exceptions to that. Get out of the building or something, you know. But such behavior only demonstrates to the child that mommy or daddy's out of control and that they, in fact, are not in charge here. Made this note just before I was sitting on the front pew up here typing this in because I thought of it on the way here. Remember reading a number of decades ago about a missionary in Africa. Can't remember his name, can't remember much detail about it at all, but he had a small son, I believe he was 3 or 4 years old, and the boy was playing under a tree, not a terebinth tree that I know of, but some kind of a large tree over there in Africa, and the father happened to look that way, and he saw a snake making its way down the tree toward the boy. He yelled at his boy and said, "Drop to the ground." Boy dropped to the ground immediately. He said, "Make your way over here as fast as you can." Boy started crawling. I don't know why the technique. I don't know anything about it. Don't know what kind of snake it was. Maybe it didn't attack kids on all fours. I don't know. But that's what it said. And the boy did exactly what he was told. Now imagine him saying, "Drop to the ground." The little boy says, "Why?" "Because I said drop to the ground." "I don't want to." You know how this can go. If you think asking why is a legitimate, why, asking such a question, why, of a legitimate source of authority, if you think that's appropriate to do, try doing that the next time a legitimate source of authority tells you to do something. You're driving down the road, you come up on a half a dozen police cruisers. Their lights are all flashing. You decide to get out and mosey on over and see what the ruckus is all about. An officer says firmly, "Stay in your car." Now here's a test to see how well you were raised. Are you going to say, "Why?" Your boss tells you to do something. You have to appear before a judge. Your professor tells all the students they have to have an assignment done by Friday. You're going to ask why to all these questions? Imagine a college professor arguing about quantum physics with an arrogant, defiant third grader who doesn't even understand basic math or basic science. Professor says, "Quantum theory is the theoretical basis of modern physics that explains the nature and behavior of matter and energy on the atomic and subatomic levels." Third grader says, "I don't believe that." Professor says, "You don't believe what?" Third grader says, "Whatever you said about codum, whatever." "Well, you better believe it. It's well-supported science." "I don't have to believe that." "Yes, you do." "No, I don't." Well, the professor takes a breath. He gets his bearings, and he continues his lecture. "The nature and behavior of matter and energy at that level is sometimes referred to as quantum physics, I sound like the third grader, and quantum mechanics, some unified field theories that are classified as quantum gravity theories include Euclidean quantum gravity, Wheeler-DeWitt equation," and he lists about a half a dozen more. Third grader says, "You're just making that up." "No, I'm not." "Yes, you are." "No, I'm not." Is there something wrong with this picture? I've seen parents behave this way, arguing with a 3, 4, 5-year-old child. To argue with a child like this is to treat the child as a peer, to treat the child as if he were a peer. Although the interesting thing is we usually don't treat our peers that way. But to argue with a child like this makes the child arrogant, rebellious, and powerful. and it makes the child disrespectful towards everyone else. Have you ever wondered why the Ten Commandments were so concise? Exodus 20, verses 1 through 17, not going to read all of it. But three of the commands contain very little comment beyond their simple prohibition of you shall not. You shall not make for yourself an image. Then it has a few other things in there talking about the nature of God and so forth. You shall not misuse the name of the Lord your God. You shall not covet it. Then there are two that are not negatives. They're not prohibitions. That's remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Honor your father and your mother. But five out of the ten commands are simple, one-line, brief, very brief prohibitions. They are this: you shall have no other gods before me, period. You shall not murder, period. You shall not commit adultery, period. You shall not steal, period. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor, period. Why were these very important commands so concise? Because these commands were not open for discussion or negotiation. There's no room for debate. There's no honor your father and your mother, okay? These are not questions. God was not trying to get them to buy into these ideas, and they are not suggestions. They were simple declarative statements. Do this, don't do that. It's clear who's in charge here. And it needs to be clear who's in charge in the home. Another thing I remembered right before the lesson. Colby was 3 or 4 or 5 at the most. We were at a family gathering. I'm not going to say which family. But it doesn't matter. I'm being silly. And I can't remember, it was Christmas time or something, and Colby had maybe gone over and gotten something off of a shelf and that he shouldn't have and brought it over to me, and I just told him to go put it back up, and he immediately turned and walked over and put it back on the shelf. And an uncle was sitting there, and he just marveled at that. He said, "Boy, he just did what you told him to do, didn't you?" What was he supposed to do? But that goes back to expectations, doesn't it? And that man had several children, all of whom would have had to have been dragged and beat and everything else to have done what he told them to do. It's clear who's in charge when God speaks and the way he speaks. It needs to be clear who's in charge in the home. When parents are out of control, when they explain everything, when they argue with their children, they are not in charge and the children know it. Some parents don't know how to be strong and firm without being nasty and mean. And once again, that brings us back to the parents. That's what Parenting 101 is about. Romans 8:29 tells us from the New Living Translation, God knew his people in advance, and he chose them to be like his son, so that his son would be the firstborn among many brothers and sisters. We are to be becoming more and more like Christ. We need to fix ourselves. We need to consider how God treats people. We need to consider how God treats his children. If you can't picture Jesus talking that way to a child, if you can't picture Jesus acting that way toward a child, if you can't picture Jesus treating a child that way, then you shouldn't be talking that way to your child. You shouldn't be acting that way to your child. You shouldn't be treating your child that way. Sometimes we find ourselves trying to make things seem so complicated. Often they're pretty simple. Hope these thoughts have been helpful.